many of us don't give other people room to make mistakes. We're only human, so if we are learning, we must make mistakes. But nowadays, a lot of people feel that if someone, or even ourselves, makes a mistake, that door for further opportunity is closed permanently. Is that person you? This is Between Us, Stories of Unconscious Bias. I am Smita Tharoor. Welcome, listeners. I'd like to introduce Damien Taylor. Damien Taylor has spent the last 15 years applying data and technology to entertainment. Both analytical and creative, he brings a unique skill set that's in high demand for brands and media companies. However, being Black in media and technology, Damien has experienced firsthand the impact of pervasive unconscious biases. Damien has now begun the journey of helping to bring those biases to light for himself and for others. So I know that my conversation with Damien today about stories of unconscious bias is going to reveal a lot, not just for me, but for all of us listeners. So thank you so very much, Damien, for joining me on this conversation.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be on the show and to talk about this.
So, you know, unconscious bias, Damien, how do you understand those words? You know, you've already talked about pervasive unconscious biases, so you've used those words. What does that mean to you?
To me, in my experience, it's when a person or people or society have perceptions about a particular behavior, culture, or member of that cultural group, and the expectations around what that person should or should not be doing, what is or isn't acceptable for them, and their role in society. And sometimes those can be positive, sometimes those can be negative, but it's something that, for the most part, people accept as fact, not understanding that it's an interpretation. There's a specific level of translation that goes on in our minds to create those rules. It's not something that is fact. And so a lot of times we just are unaware of it. It's something that we either don't acknowledge or don't realize that we're doing.
We're just kind of taking it for granted. It's like normal is what you're saying.
Exactly. We normalize it.
We normalize it, yeah. And in fact, also for the listeners, I need to point out that, I mean, we know you're Black because that's how I introduced you. But I need to point out, and I'm guessing people would know by the accent, that you live in the United States and you live in Los Angeles. And in fact, you are in LA right now, having just had breakfast while I'm in London, in cold London, unfortunately. And so when you talk about normalizing it, whatever it means, which you're going to explain to me in a minute, it's also, I suppose, under the headline of where you live and where you've been brought up. Am I correct?
Correct. No, definitely. It's something that, at least for me, has been pervasive throughout virtually every aspect of my life. You talked a little bit about my accent before we began, and that's something that people always comment on. You don't sound like you're from LA. You don't sound like you're Black. And so those are all things that we've assumed now. This is how someone from LA or someone who's Black should speak. But then when someone doesn't match with that, it creates this sometimes friction in our minds or this inability to compute, but sometimes it doesn't do anything. It makes somebody more interesting. But whatever the case, that's an example of an unconscious bias.
Yes, of course it is. Yeah, absolutely. So give me some more detail. I mean, if you can share a story, that would be great, Damien.
Yeah, I think we can probably start with my accent. That's probably the easiest. And it's something that, it's interesting. It's something where I know I have a bias now. For a while, it was unconscious. Now I'm very aware of it, but then a lot of other people are not. And so when we moved to this world of being just virtual for the most part, I realized that one of the comments I stopped getting was like, oh, I didn't expect you to be Black. At least I get it less now. Before, though, when it was in person or an interview or we were going to coordinate a meeting, our first conversation would be by phone. And most people, by my name and my voice, couldn't tell what ethnicity or race I was, whether I was Black or whatever. And so the default assumption was usually white. Since they couldn't tell, then the default became, well, the reset or the place where we all start, the basis for everything, should be white. And then when I walk in the room, I've had a lot of, oh, wait, you're Black. People just exclaiming it or sometimes being shocked. And it's not just white people who said that. It was virtually everyone. Showing that just throughout society, we have this perception of what someone who's Black should sound like or what their name should be.
How interesting.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but I have some fantastic news for you. Today's podcast is sponsored by Audible. You've all heard of Audible. But here's a fun fact. If you listen to every single title on Audible, you'll be listening for more than 3 centuries. Other important things you need to know? Every month, members get 1 credit to pick any title, plus 2 Audible originals from a monthly selection, and access to daily news digests from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. But let's imagine you're having a crazy month with no personal time, or can't decide what to listen to. Don't worry, you can keep your credits for up to a year. But here's the best bit. You've all heard my podcast. Did you know that 10 of my guests have their books on Audible? 9 out of 10 have narrated it themselves, so you can hear the speaker read their own books. Lem Sisse's powerful My Name Is Why, or Kate Nichols' very moving Under the Camel Thorn Tree are just 2 examples. But perhaps what you want is to further explore the subject of unconscious bias, in which case you have 13 books to choose from, including Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, my absolute favorite to understand how our brains work. All you have to do for a free book and a free month subscription is to sign up to audibletrial.com/Tharoor Associates. That's www.audibletrial.com/Tharoor Associates. Thanks so much for listening.
Funny enough, because I'm hearing your accent, and when we met before this interview as well, I felt it wasn't about whether you were Black or white. In fact, I wouldn't have assumed that your accent is white because you don't sound Black. And that wasn't at all my point. But my unconscious bias was kicking in, and I was wondering whether you had lived in some other country, maybe even the United Kingdom for some years, because of certain words that you pronounce differently. I think you stress on the turf or water rather than, I'm not good at accents, but water is the way, perhaps how Americans say it. And those were the kind of things that were coming up in my mind rather than ethnicity, funnily enough, but influence of other countries, maybe where you lived or grew up.
There's a huge influence. I lived in Spain for a while. I lived in Chile for a while. And one of the reasons why I ended up with a unique accent was in speaking Spanish. Sometimes the way I translate words in English is through Spanish first, and it just simplifies things for me. And when I wasn't living in the U.S., it became easier with people who didn't speak English to pronounce English words with a British accent because they were more likely to understand it. It wasn't something intentional, but I realized that when I did that, they'd suddenly get what I was saying. Ironically, though, when I speak Spanish, no one believes and then I'm really from California because I sound like I'm from the Caribbean. And that was just a factor of the people who I spent time with when I was learning Spanish when I was younger. And so no matter what language I'm speaking, I always seem to have this very hard-to-place aberrant accent.
Which is brilliant, isn't it? So it kind of makes you unique, don't you think?
Oh, I love it. I think it's great. But I remember being younger and when people would say that, it would frustrate me a lot. Partially because, so in the U.S., there is this, and this is where one of my biases come in when it comes to accents. My parents even felt this way. People shouldn't be able to identify you as Black, because if they do, they're going to think you're lesser, that you're not going to be as smart. And so anyone who had a quote-unquote accent that could be construed as Black, I realized that I had a, you're not playing the game, you're not doing it right, right? Like, oh, you must not be very smart. And I actually had that misperception as well, just because it had been so deeply ingrained in me. And my younger brother, very intentionally, he fell in love with Southern accents and became very attached to this Texas accent. And then he took that a step further and was trying to figure out what's the Blackest, most Texas accent I can come up with. And he just took it all on. So we don't sound alike at all. We actually don't even look alike at all. People don't know that we're necessarily brothers even. And with that, I was always like, hey, stop doing that. Why are you doing that? People are going to think you're stupid. You're not. And it was always my perception that if you had that, then you weren't actually intelligent. Realizing now that if I'm telling my brother, stop doing that because people aren't going to know how smart he clearly isn't stupid, right? And the accent isn't the betrayer of intelligence. And when I think about my grandfather, who had a very strong Southern accent, very typical Black Southern accent, but graduated high school when he was 15. Clearly not a dumb person, right? He's super intelligent, and when you would listen to him speak, you would know that. But because of his accent and the color of his skin, it was perceived as not being that way. And I remember thinking the whole time, I didn't want that to happen to me.
I think that's actually the point, you see, because there are a couple of things here that you've mentioned that I want to kind of capture for the listeners and for myself. One, of course, is the fact that your parents felt very, very strongly about it, and mm-hmm. they brought you up, and it was ingrained in you. So if we go back to the parents, your parents, my parents, the world over, our parents have certain experiences. And what they want to make sure is that if it's a negative, difficult experience, they want to protect their children from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want X, whatever X might be, to happen to their own children. In this instance, it was about your grandparents, your grandfather, and then, of course, your parents possibly as well, being judged purely on the way they sound. And, of course, the fact that they are Black. It is a combination of the two. But let's just focus on the accent bit, because that's the kind of the story that we're talking about and exploring right now. And then you, therefore, kind of, it was so ingrained in your DNA, you worked very hard to fight it. Whereas your brother, on the other hand, fought it in a different kind of way. He said, what do you mean? I'm not going to do what mom and dad said. I'm actually going to embrace it and become mm-hmm. even more Black and more Southern than my actual roots and my ethnicity and my upbringing suggest.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's a Black Southern accent or whether it's what you call a received pronunciation British English accent or whether it's an English medium educated Indian accent in speaking in English or another accent, I'm talking about people speaking in English in, let's say, Nigeria, mm-hmm. and I can think of another half a dozen examples that we won't go through right now, it's the same story.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the extra layer, which you talked about, may make people assuming that you're white rather than Black. But let's just take Nigeria as a country where English is in the constitution. It is the language that people speak, one of the languages that everybody speaks. Depending on your socioeconomic background and the education that you have, your accent will sound different. Therefore, you are judged mm-hmm. unconsciously on the abilities that you might have, how clever you might be, and how you're going to succeed at work.
Mm-hmm.
So that accent issue, I think, is a very common one the world over, don't you think?
Oh, incredibly. I just finished a project with a linguist, and one of the things that I learned from her is, in terms of just how people react, most people, if not all people, don't necessarily have the ability to separate the person from the speech. And so when they hear the accent or the speech, when they judge it, they actually are making a judgment about the person and not necessarily segregating the two, which makes it really interesting. And that's one of the things that really highlighted for me my own biases that, wait a minute, I think that I'm just talking about the way that they speak, but really what I'm saying is this person is X, whatever that is.
Absolutely. You're so right. And it's interesting that you're exploring that further with the linguist. But tell us more, Damien. I mean, what other kind of stories can you share? Accent certainly is interesting that it's such a common story around the world, how we judge people based on how we speak.
Yeah, no, I think accents is probably one of the simplest ones, but one that was more recent and definitely more shocking to me was, and I talked a little bit about this on my podcast, is midway, fairly early in my career, I worked at a company and my supervisor, actually both of my supervisors were women. And interestingly, most of my career, my supervisors have always been women, all of the management. It's a very unusual career track, but it's been very helpful. And I've learned so much in having that, just in terms of how to relate to people who don't look like you, who don't have the same life experiences as you. And in this one particular case, it was interesting because it was actually a negative experience. The first time that I had a truly negative experience. And it was based on my gender. It was a boss who was pretty flagrant in her distaste for men. And it was not only uncomfortable, but it was very, it had a material impact on my career, whether I got promoted or not, the sorts of things that I was able to do. The women were afforded the ability to work from home and work remotely. I was not, even though we would have everything else equal, living the same distance, doing the same job, etc. And even in meetings, there would be comments about how useless men are. and how it takes a woman to really do it. Men think they're doing everything, but women actually are the ones who do all the work. It was very demeaning. And I realized in that moment that the fact that I could be shocked by having that experience, and the fact that I could be appalled by never having had that experience except for that one time, was really indicative of a certain privilege that I had. Yes, I might be Black, but I'm also male. And there are a lot of rooms that I'm allowed into, a lot of conversations that I'm allowed into, a lot of things that happen that I'm privy to, or that I can even just ignore and let slide because I'm male. And for the first time, I realized that not everybody has that privilege. And my assumption was it's just the way the world is. And that if at the time, well, I mean, you just have to think like a man then. And I was like, oh my God, this is such a sexist thought. I can't believe I thought that, right? But it was just, I assumed that's how business was. And that was a norm, right? And so if we wanted to conform to the culture of business, we just had to do what everybody who was there already was doing.
I find that really interesting because in some strange way, even though you felt demeaned and lesser than, and it was probably quite traumatic for you at the time, we can also thank that lady supervisor because she gave you the opportunity to reflect about one's own privileges. Isn't that what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly. And it also, I became very adamant about the fact that I didn't want anyone who ever worked with me or for me to have to feel like I was feeling in that moment, right? Suddenly, I was able to have empathy for what women in the workplace may have been feeling, right? Like, this is not good. This is not comfortable. It doesn't make you want to do more for work. And I didn't want anyone else to have to feel that way. And so it actually changed the way that I approached my career. It's not saying that before that I was like this big chauvinist or whatever, but I just assumed that the behavior that happened in the office was the way that it worked. And so I became complicit in a culture and in behaviors that are unacceptable and are just, quite frankly, hurtful to others, right? And I wanted to make sure that going forward, I wasn't perpetuating that scenario.
I mean, again, I'm thinking of the word normal or normalize, because when you say you became complicit, I mean, you took it for granted. But what are we saying when you say complicit? You know, what kind of things were you just taking for granted or normalizing in terms of behavior?
So here's an example. I remember this boss, this female boss, we were in her office and it was her and the head of one of our statistical groups and another woman and me. And she had just got a new assistant who was a young guy in his early 20s, really good looking guy. And I remember them talking and, oh my God, he's so hot. The things I would do to him, oh, that young boy. And it was just really kind of gross and not cool, right? But
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but, no, but it's so common amongst yeah. men sitting together. And,
exactly.
I think
exactly.
It's brilliant.
And so it was the exact scenario that I had been subjected to with men too, right? But then at the time, it's like, that's just how men are. But women are not supposed to be that way. And I realized that, wait a minute, why am I so much more offended by this? But then I'm willing to brush it off when I hear men doing that in the same meeting about another assistant or someone else, right? And that is where I realized that I became complicit, because by not stopping that conversation when it's happening or not saying, hey, you know, that's really inappropriate. How do you think that would make her feel if she were in here? Would you be okay saying that if she came into the room? And if so, that's just not cool. Or would you want HR to hear that? Without saying something, I became complicit in allowing that behavior to continue.
Actually, and that's a very powerful point you're making, Damon, because this idea of being complicit when we listen to conversations and other people's conversations is so very common. All of us around the world may say we don't have prejudices, we're not biased, we like to be liberal and accepting and inclusive in the society that we live in. And yet we could be in a group of people where someone says something that at some level clearly is not accepting or inclusive and shows a judgment about a situation, a person, whatever it might be. And our silence would then mean that actually we're not as inclusive and liberal and accepting as we say we are. And that, I think, is very, very important for all of us to acknowledge, for all the listeners to appreciate, because opening our mouths and actually saying something as gently as possible, you know, hey, miss, did you realize that you said something that's actually quite inappropriate? Maybe you shouldn't. Because sometimes when someone says something, they don't even realize that they're offending others. And if you're hearing it or I'm hearing it and we don't flag it up, we are reinforcing what they think is perfectly normal. That's what you're saying. And I think that's actually a very powerful point that all of us should take away. So thank you for that. Yeah.
And to be frank, or totally transparent, it's hard because just talking about these two stories means that I have to admit areas where I had a flaw, where I was potentially causing harm to someone else, right? And that's not an easy thing to do. We like to think of ourselves as not having those flaws, and having to confront that is very difficult. And to say it publicly, even right now, that's something that 2-3 years ago I would never do, right? No, you don't want anyone to think that you're a sexist. But we all have biases. Am I a sexist? Not intentionally, but I'm sure there are still things that my wife would say that I do that are just, did you really just say that? Or did you really just do that? But as I become aware of those things, the key is that I start to make a conscious effort to correct and understand why those things are doing harm.
Absolutely. So again, people often make assumptions when we use the word sexist, that it's usually men about women, but it can be the other way around as well, as you correctly said in your own experience.
I think that the trick is a lot of people assume that as soon as you admit to something like that, it makes you a terrible person. No, we all have those unconscious biases. We grow up in a society that builds around specific norms and behaviors, but it's our responsibility to question them and be okay to change when we understand that those are no longer either serving or are hurtful to the society and the people around us.
But when I was introducing you earlier, Damien, we talked about the fact that you are now working on actually exploring this idea of pervasive unconscious bias, both with yourself and with others. So was there a story there that perhaps you could share with us? Was there a trigger, or was it a series of events that led you to what you're thinking and doing now?
It's been a very long journey. I'd venture to say a lifelong journey, just in the myriad of experiences that I've had. But I would say that the final catalyst that helped everything to coalesce and really spark the transition was, as with so many people, 2020, the events of 2020. They all hit home particularly hard for me. So there was the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd and Central Park Karen and Ahmaud Arbery being shot while he's going out for a jog. And all of those things happening within a 2-week period in the middle of a pandemic. And then that pandemic with the anti-Asian rhetoric and hateful speech coming into play. Both of those things touched my family very closely. My wife is Asian. And so at first I was very concerned about me going out. Am I going to be shot when I go for a run because people think that I don't belong in whatever neighborhood? But then you have this pandemic, and can my wife go to work? Can she go outside with my son and be okay without someone yelling about the Chinese flu in her face or something? And now feeling a heightened sense of my family being in peril really made me realize that a lot of what people were doing and saying and reacting to was based on a couple things. One, a lack of experience with the groups or the cohorts that they were rallying against. And the second being their only exposure to those people or concepts was through media, which is common through so many people's lives. If you don't have access to a specific culture or group or cohort, the little bit that you do becomes the whole, the totality of your perception of that group. And I realized that during that time, I wasn't going to go out in the middle of a pandemic and protest. That just didn't seem wise to me. That didn't seem like the best use of my time. But what I could do, and something that I did have at my disposal, was research and analytics. Those are things that I'm very strong at, and the ability to create and distribute media. So I was going to take those two things and leverage those to help challenge a lot of the biases that people have. So I started creating content. We're working on an animated series right now. We were doing a podcast at the time, but content that really challenged perceptions about what it means to be Black and what it means to be Asian and who is which. We started doing a podcast about professionalism at work and not only unconscious biases, but just diversity and discrimination and some things that are good and bad, and bringing in experts to help individuals be able to understand how can they improve their workplaces and talk about these things without shame, without fear. So it was all anonymously submitted to our podcast, and we would bring in an expert to talk about what you as an individual can do today without waiting for your company, your county, country, whatever it may be, to do something. And then research. I worked on a project that was 1.5 years long about the words and the language of diversity and talking about words matter and how can we speak in a way that's inclusive and what are the words that are triggering and divisive so that companies can actually start to speak in a way such that it's edifying and helping the conversation versus being divisive and laden with jargon, because we so often get, oh, the word is blah, blah, blah. Let's use that word. And
so give me an example of a word that you think is commonly used and is divisive, because I think the listeners would be very interested in knowing that too, which we need to think about. I mean, you've also worked with the linguists. So the whole idea of language and words used is clearly something that is very important when we're thinking about being discriminatory or being divisive in any way. So do you have an example you could share?
Yeah, one of the simplest examples is probably the one that we think is the most innate, is the word diversity. So often we assume that when we say diversity, everybody has the same definition. And what we discovered is that that's not nearly the case. There are so many various definitions. And what ends up happening is if you're a company or you're an individual and you just say the word diversity or diversity, equity, inclusivity, any of those words, and you just toss them out, assuming that everyone knows what you mean, people have their own definitions of it. So when I say diversity, I may mean bringing women into the workplace. When someone else says it, they may be bringing, you know, LGBTQIA, or they might be Black people or whatever. And when they don't see their definition of diversity reflected in what you just did, then suddenly it becomes, see, I knew this diversity thing wasn't true, or you were going to let me down. You know, so the fact that we use these words that we think are universally defined, and they really aren't, makes it really difficult. And so we have to start speaking in definitions.
And that's actually very, very important, isn't it? Because it just comes back down to what you said much earlier, but I think it's linked, certainly in my editors. It's our narrative. You know, we talked about just accents and parenting. You know, I'm kind of briefly summarizing what we talked about earlier on. But it's our narrative. What kind of experiences do we have? What kind of values do we have? What is it that makes us tick? And so even when I look at the word diversity, I will say, maybe being a woman, that it is about being more inclusive about women. And I'm just being deliberately simple here. And you might say, because you're Black, it's about, you know, accepting and making sure that more Black people have opportunity. And somebody else might say something else based on their story, their narrative, and what that means to them. And that's what we all do. Mm-hmm. But what we don't realize is that when I'm talking about what's important to me, it's not necessarily what's important to you. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're flagging up in the idea of language and how we use language in communicating and not being divisive. Is that correct?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And you actually touched on another point that we discovered, was that the way that the everyday person talks about issues of unconscious bias, diversity, et cetera, is actually through stories, through personal stories and their relation to the concept, not through these very academic terms that we so often fall into when we're trying to simplify. And so what we discovered with the companies we were working with is that for them, it's really important to allow those stories of employees, of customers, to really shine through, and not to just say, hey, we are diverse, we're inclusive. Instead, let people talk about it in the way that...
Why do you think I do this podcast?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, actually, that neatly leads to another question. Have you another story you might be able to share with us about your learning and understanding of unconscious bias?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that I came up with is around unconscious bias. And this was just recently on my podcast.
Sorry, just to interrupt. Listeners, I'm just letting you know that at the end, when we write down the words, there will also be a link to Damien's podcast so you can find it and hear it. So yes, coming back to you, Damien.
Oh, yes, yes. So my podcast called Professional Confession, where people anonymously would submit their stories of diversity in the workplace, good, bad, ugly, whatever. One of my episodes, and it was probably one of the most difficult, I was meeting with an author who happens to be a white male, and he wrote a book called White Men, How to Go from Fragile to Agile, and talked about just diversity and why diversity is good for everyone, including white men. And I wanted to do that because, one, it was interesting to me, but it's the first time I had heard of someone who was sort of in the what's been the maligned group so far, and in a lot of cases, unjustifiably so. But he had a very interesting perspective and talked about how difficult it was and how hard it was for him in his work, talking about diversity, realizing that he lived from a perspective where he had privileges, but he didn't realize they were privileges because it's just what he'd always known. In his parlance, it was like telling a fish, hey, you're swimming in water. The fish is asking, what's water? What are you talking about? And so I thought it was going to be a really great conversation. I was really excited to do it. And the closer we got to it, the more nervous I became and the more scared I became. And I actually, when we first started, had to fight the urge of just clamming up, right, and being stoic, because I realized that I had unconsciously created this wall or this bias, like, this is something that you don't talk about with white men. And it was the, they can't handle it, so they're either going to be very judgmental or be in your face, or you're going to say something that's going to piss him off, and you're just, I don't feel like dealing with the confrontation. And that was tricky. That was the first time where I realized that I had made an assumption about him and who he was and what he was going to do, despite the book that we were talking about, despite his book and all his work that he had done. I had made an assumption about him and who he was and what he was going to say and do before he had even done anything.
Opened his mouth, yeah. You had put him into a box and you'd locked it up and thrown the key away, hadn't you, pretty much?
Exactly, exactly. And it was all in the sense of protecting myself, right?
Absolutely, that's what we do. That's exactly what we do instinctively, because we want to stay safe. We want to make sure that we're all right. And because we have had negative experiences, we don't want those experiences to happen again. And so we bring this wall around us to keep ourselves safe. Absolutely.
And that was interesting, because I realized that if I wanted this episode to work, if I wanted this podcast to actually do well, I had to be willing to be vulnerable and risk that, to have that real conversation and not fall into the camp of what I had accused so many other people of doing. You put me into a box and I never even got to open my mouth yet. I had just done the same thing. And so it was tricky, but as the conversation went on, I became more and more relaxed and I allowed myself to be more and more open to what he was saying and being vulnerable. And it ended up being a really great conversation. And I learned a lot and I gained empathy, because I think so often the thought is, oh, you're a white guy, it's easy for you. And just because you're male and white doesn't mean that your life is easy and that everything just comes to you. And it also doesn't mean that this process of recognizing and understanding that you have a privilege and what that means is easy. And why does that seem scary? And suddenly when we were talking, I started to realize that I could empathize with some of the things that he was saying, like why it would be threatening to have someone suddenly saying, oh, the white men are doing blah, blah, blah to us, right? Because I remember working at a studio, and at the time it was, we have to make sure we're getting the black audience. And so I was the, you know, go-to person for everything. And then suddenly it became, oh, you know, Hispanics are going to surpass black people in terms of the biggest minority population. Sideline the black people. It's Hispanics or black. And there was this zero-sum game of either or, not thinking about the fact that all of those different cohorts and people exist. And we should be talking to all of them, not just one or the other. And so that either or zero sum game actually still plays up now with how people talk about diversity a lot of times. It's the, we'll take that away from someone to give this to someone else. And until we break that cycle, it makes it really challenging for anyone.
I mean, it's literally and metaphorically black versus white. You know, it's not an either or, is it? It's, we all as human beings are so nuanced and so multi-nuanced and have so many different layers about us. And people assume, which is what you were saying, that because I'm black, obviously I'll have nothing in common with a white guy. But of course, as you start talking and exploring and understanding, you appreciate that there's a lot in common that you both have. Yes, of course, he has different privileges that you may not have, but I'm sure you have some privileges that he does not have. And we don't appreciate that of ourselves. So, you know, that story you've shared is actually extremely powerful. So thank you for that.
I have a colleague who actually said this, and it made me really think a couple of weeks ago, where he pointed out that at some point we are all privileged and disadvantaged at the same time. And until we recognize that, we're going to have a lot of difficulty assuming that someone has all the privilege.
Beautifully said. At some point, we're all privileged and disadvantaged at the same time. So don't just hang your hat up and say, oh, look at me, poor me. Nor do you wander around looking extremely self-satisfied and think that you're amazing and king of the castle. Because we're all a bit of everything. That is extremely well said, your friend. So you're exploring, you're researching, you've got this podcast. Can you share the name of it again?
Professional Confession.
Professional Confession. That's easy enough to remember, listeners. Professional Confession, Damien Taylor. And you should be able to easily find it to hear the stories that are shared on there. So they're teaching you those things. But what about you on a daily basis? How do you manage your own, you know, unconscious biases?
It's interesting. I take the time to, and this is where suddenly as I get older, I realize, oh, my parents are so brilliant, right? Because my parents had a certain experience here in the U.S. being Black and growing up through civil rights, etc. But even with that, my mom especially has always been very much the stop and take stock in why you're doing or saying what you're doing. Is it just because someone else has always done it? And if so, do you know why they did it? If you don't know the purpose of it, then you're more likely to end up abusing that, right? I think her saying was, you know, where your purpose is unknown, abuse is inevitable because you don't know what you're doing. And so I really try to be cognizant of what I'm doing, but since I'm blind to my own faults, I have a very close-knit group of few people who I ask and let them actually, and I know that they're very honest with me. They don't work to spare my feelings. They will let me know, hey, yeah, no, that was kind of not cool, or you're okay. Just make sure that when you're doing that, you don't do it this way. That really helps to have a small group of people who you can trust.
Well, yes, a sounding board, really, isn't it?
Yeah. They're people who are notably different from me, and so they can bring a different experience than what I have and allow me to see and acknowledge some of my blind spots.
And I'm sure it would be the same for your friends, the close group, because you would be supporting them in a similar way, which is fantastic. So it's kind of your own group of challenging each other, not challenging perhaps is the wrong word, but supporting each other and making sure that you do continue to self-reflect and explore and understand what makes us tick as human beings. That's what you're saying.
Exactly. And we give each other room for making mistakes. And that's where I think is really hard for just a lot of people, is we don't give people room to make mistakes. If people are learning, they're going to make mistakes. And if they make an attempt to correct and learn from those mistakes, it's great. But right now, it seems like a lot of the conversations are, you should just know, or if you don't know, figure it out and don't make a mistake, versus acknowledging, you made a mistake, that's fine. Let's not do it again. And here's why that was a mistake.
To self-reflect, acknowledge that, yes, none of us are perfect and we might make mistakes, and then see if we can try not to repeat that error, really. And it's simple enough if we can think about it.
And I try to do that for others, is to allow them to make that mistake. And
that's great.
But like forgiving in the delivery of, hey, this is why that could cause harm, or that made me feel this way, or that could be construed as whatever.
Yeah. No, it makes complete sense. Simple, but yes, extremely effective way of actually managing our own unconscious biases. So for listeners, for those of you who want to listen to Damien's podcast, do search for it. Would you like to repeat it one more time, Damien?
Yes, it's called Professional Confession. It's just like
and
it sounds.
And it's Damien Taylor. So there's three opportunities there for you to find it. I'll also put it in the notes with the podcast. Damien Taylor, thank you very much for sharing your stories of unconscious bias with me today.
Thank you so much for having me and allowing me to share them. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. I have been told that this podcast is ranked in the top 3% globally and heard by people in 98 countries. Thank you, listener, wherever you are, whether it's Albania, Afghanistan, Nigeria or Nepal, Sweden or Saudi Arabia. We could not have this podcast without you, the listener. As always, if you like this episode, please do share. I would also like to thank Jack Godfrey for his original music for season 6.